My guest tonight made a documentary about our broken public school system. It's so important, I suggest all you kids skip school tomorrow to see it. Please welcome Kevin Soling. Soling, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, sir, you have a new documentary called The War on Kids. All right, what's the war? How can I sign up? Okay, because it is us or them. They are here to replace us, and I will not stand for it.
Well,
hit it.
The war is being fought by anyone who supports the current incarnation of public education. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes...
I support it with my tax dollars, sir.
Everyone, or most people, seem to support it, many inadvertently and many with the best intentions. Mm-hmm. The problem is that schools have now been transformed into effectively prisons.
What do you mean, prisons?
There is a tremendous effort on school security, which has taken precedent over education. You have security cameras in the hallways, sometimes in the classrooms. You have metal detectors.
It has to protect us from the kids and from the kids from each other. those metal detectors are not spraying up out of nowhere.
It is there, but it's the environment that actually creates that kind of, the need for the security.
But what's it doing to the kids? Why is this a war on kids?
Normal childhood behavior has been pathologized such that you have a situation where we're constantly drugging kids. We have up to perhaps 8 million kids who are on antidepressants or stimulants or something for ADD and other types of...
Like Ritalin, things like that.
Absolutely.
And?
Basically, if you were to imagine...
So they're on these things?
But
that helps the pharmaceutical companies?
It
helps the teachers and that helps the kids?
It absolutely does. It doesn't help the kids, though. The situation is a response to the oppressive environments of the classroom. If you were to imagine taking...
Wait a second. What would you rather the kids be on? Drugs?
Well, it's the environment... There is very little difference between these drugs, or virtually no difference between these drugs and the same drugs that have been made illegal. And basically what's happened with the kids in the classrooms is that we're drugging them to make them adapt and conform to these oppressive environments that have taken place in the schools.
What is wrong with conformity? Okay, conformity is great, isn't it? See, the majority agrees that conformity is great.
Conformity is the antithesis to American ideals and American spirit, and I would imagine you, for one, would want a society where everyone has the potential to be self-actualized.
Exactly. Everyone should be able to do what they believe I want them to.
Well,
but what are you saying it was better at some point in the past? Kids have always been trouble for teachers.
There never was a golden age of schooling, and that's actually one of the fallacies. Schooling actually was a Prussian model. It was conceived in the
18th model.
Yes, it was.
They wore shiny boots.
It was conceived in the 1800s as a military model to get people to become good soldiers, where they wouldn't ask questions and they could behave in a docile manner. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution, there was a factory model, and you had different classrooms and the bell ringing and all the different subjects broken
down. So schools are kid factories?
They were there to train kids so that they could adopt it to factory lifestyle, which is partly why school is still today incredibly boring. Now, what's happened is you have...
Stay in school, kids.
Now what's happened is because of media hype and fear, you have this over-dependence on security, and the prison model has been adopted. In fact, the same architects who have designed prisons are the same ones designing the new schools.
Now, you went to minimum security prisons
I went to one in Ohio and compared it with a tour of an average school in New Jersey. And the amazing thing was that the prison was pretty much superior in every single way. If you were a parent and you didn't know that one was a prison, one was a school, you would readily send your kid to the prison. It was better taken care of.
That would be a penny saver.
The school day actually starts when the alarm rings in the morning, because the child's day is actually consumed the minute they wake up, because they've got to get ready for school. And usually that whole routine is a nightmare for a lot of parents, because they're trying to get the kid up. The kid doesn't want to get up. You know, they're not motivated. Who would want to get up and go to prison? parents trying to get everything going. Sometimes there's other kids, there's chaos. Parents got to get to work. School's just a big babysitting factory.
I hate Thursdays. They're the hardest day to wake up ever. Mondays are pretty bad too. Wednesdays are annoying because you want it to be Thursday, so tomorrow's Friday. Fridays are hard because of the tests and stuff, but at least you get to sleep in the next few days.
Child gets to school. Maybe parents have had a had a fight. Maybe child's been abused all morning. Maybe they've been screamed and yelled at. Maybe the routine was so distasteful that they're entering school, possibly with a very already having a bad day. And they get there, and there might be some designated time that kids can socialize. And then when the bell rings, if especially in the high school ages, kids are not on time, they're sanctioned for it. They can get detentions, they get a demerit, whatever it's called. They're immediately forced to, you know, sit in their little designated chairs and basically sit down and shut up.
There is absolutely no justification for the sequence of subjects in any school in the country. There is no justification. And by following one by another, you confuse people and bewilder them. All that's left behind is the need to do well on the test. So let's, for the sake of argument, say that you are finally caught up in the wonder, the glamour of quadratic equations. A bell rings. Everyone clears out. The teacher says, come on, you'll be late for your next class. You say, I'm lost in the magic of quadratic equations. I want to finish this. You can't finish. Why not? I don't know why not. Because you have to go and think poetically. And then when you're lost in the rapture of an Italian sonnet and just about to come up with that tricky missing rhyme, the bell rings and somebody says, you have to go take off your clothes and run around a filthy gymnasium and have people scream at you. If you wanted to invent a mechanism to drive people insane, I mean literally insane, so they don't follow their own best interests, so their own good common sense, that's the system you would invent.
My guest today is Kevin Soling. He is the director of The War on Kids, a documentary about the public education system in America that came out or that was finished in 2009. Kevin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yes, I'm glad to have you finally. This is certainly long overdue. I think I first heard about this project over 2 years ago. And I think my first thought was, oh, that's what I wanted to do, you know. But then I saw the movie initially when it came out, and I thought it was very well done. And I just have the greatest appreciation for that effort. I know that it was something that you worked on for like a considerable amount of time, right?
Yeah, I worked on it for about 8 years or so. There were a couple of reasons why I spent so much time on it. One was because no one had ever thought about doing a film on education before that one came out, so I didn't really think I had to rush it to the marketplace. And I guess I was sort of wrong about that, because immediately afterwards a whole flurry of movies came out. The other thing was because my statements were so controversial, I wanted to make sure that everything stated was absolutely factually correct. I didn't want to be sloppy like many other documentary filmmakers have become.
Sure.
And wanted to make sure that everything was unimpeachable, so that the message wasn't undermined by one, you know, measly, trivial, you know, factual error that, you know, again, plagued some well-intentioned films where the opponents would seize upon some, you know, something trivial and dismiss the entire argument because of that.
Now, what was it? Because you're a documentary filmmaker by trade, and there's other projects that you've worked on that are dramatically different from this. What was it that got you interested in this topic and that, you know, led you to pursuing this particular project?
Well, in many ways, I think this is the film that I was destined to make. This is sure. the one that is just closest to my heart and was an issue that has always been with me ever since I had to endure being in school when I was young and or younger. It was realizing that I could make a movie about this or try. Although I have to admit I was definitely radicalized in the process of making the movie. So I'm glad it took as long as it did. Cause initially what drove me to make the movie was seeing all the incidents of zero tolerance, spread and all these, kids getting suspended and expelled for absolutely non offenses. And I know from, you know, the instances of so many people I've talked to that the injustices that they experience, even ones that are so much, you know, more minor than the ones the kids who are expelled under zero tolerance have endured, it sticks with them for the rest of their lives. You know, they just remember these, you know, some instance of injustice that just, you know, carries with them and sticks with them. So I just kind of, originally the movie was designed or conceived to be an anti-baby boomer movie and to show kind of, how baby boomers have become these, you know, reprehensible hypocrites by fighting for freedom when they were young and becoming the most authoritarian generation since I don't really know. The imposition of all these rules and the way they took back every advancement that they might have fought for when they were young was just sickening. So the problem was that the people I was talking to were mostly baby boomers, the people yeah. I was interviewing, and many of them were academics, and academics don't like to generalize and point their finger at a generation because it is nebulous and it doesn't really mean much, and they certainly, except for Mike Mayles, who I have tremendous respect for. He's this statistician who is teaching out in California at one of the schools out there, and he was willing to. He turned out to be one of the most radical people in terms of his statements and what he was calling for, which I was so thrilled because I loved his his book Scapegoat Generation and a number of others where he's just right on and. So because none of the people I was talking to were willing to go on camera or on record and say anything about the, you know, a generation, the film evolved and originally I didn't know I was going to come to the realization that schools cannot be reformed and that they are ultimately wholly destructive institutions that are, fundamentally, you know, autocratic and to a large degree fascist in nature.
I think it's interesting too that you bring up that generation, and I from my own personal experience, I mean, obviously I'm Gen X. You look like you are too. My parents are baby boomers and very conservative. I don't want to think about the kinds of people that they voted for or are planning to vote for. But I remember going through a box of stuff in the attic and I found these Vietnam War protest posters and I was shocked by it and how people can just plug, how people could see the reality and then over time allow themselves or actively plug themselves back into it. And I've been very critical of older folks on my show in the past. And I think that there's these ways, these just accepted practices of spending the potential and the prosperity of the future generation, where it's like this currency that they can use to buy this anxiety medication that they call the status quo. War and the national debt are examples, but I think school is the clearest, like what parents understand about the education system, but still so thoughtlessly march their children into it as if there's going to be some kind of positive outcome.
Yeah, I have two sort of comments to make about that. One is I had a similar experience. I was working on a new documentary that deals with the issues about the erosion of the separation of church and state, and I was at the atheist convention. They had a rally, and then there was a convention, and they're, you know, all speaking about the issues about the problems with magical thinking and faith and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And one of the people I was talking to was a teacher, and he was someone I ended up interviewing, so I didn't want to necessarily offend him, but I just, out of respect for him, actually, I challenged him, and I told him, you realize that you're completely hypocritical because you're arguing against faith, but the education system itself is completely faith-based, because everything about it is founded on this belief that if you pursue a certain path and take a certain approach, that you're going to get results that you never get and you won't ever get. So and it's also, there's no scientific basis to it. So for instance, you have, you know, Alfie Kohn, who's written his books about, how homework is detrimental and doesn't even, it doesn't have any academic benefit to homework, and it is detrimental in terms of, children end up relating to studying and reading in general, because it creates a negative association. And in spite of evidence, research, scientific studies, schools still implement homework, and as well as the whole autocratic model itself is also one which is not conducive to learning. So you have a faith-based institution already. Why, how can you complain about introducing intelligent design or creationism or whatever in the classroom when the whole, process is not one that's founded on any kind of science? The other thing I was going to make, the other point in terms of the generational disconnect, there was a conclusion that I came to, and then I discovered Margaret Mead had already, thought this up long before I did. But there is a sense that at least I can understand that, a culture doesn't want to, is possessive of their culture. And the next generation children represent a threat. And the fundamental notion of the war on kids, actually, the reason why it's called the war on kids was, it wasn't meant to be just about school. It's the way the youth generation represents a threat to the generation in power because of their cultural affectations. They're all different. So those are always under attack, and that's something that has occurred ever since youth culture came into its own. So sure. If you look way back before the pretty much happened after the Industrial Revolution. So when you first had youth literature, comic books, well, comic books then became under attack and were considered to contribute to the corruption of children. And it was actually Senate hearings over comic books and how they should be censored. And instead of censoring them, they did something even worse, which was allowing the industry to regulate itself. Which is a de facto censorship that always is worse than government censorship in terms of its consequences. But that's what's basically, happening now. And the reason why, except what's happening now is the baby boomers have become even more abusive and aggressive in terms of their approaches towards, trying to, oppose the any manifestations of cultural difference. It's something that you must fail at automatically, but it's resulted in drugging kids and incarcerating them in these environments, every sort of ways to control them in every conceivable manner.
Sure. I think the interest of the war on comic books is an interesting example, because what I've learned, Kevin, is when you don't want to look at the root causes of something, it's very important that you declare a war on a noun, right? If you don't want to examine how you got into a crisis, if you don't want to go back and say, what's our role? How does our thinking contribute to this problem, or what is manifested today? Yeah, you just declare a war on a noun and you take it from there. You're completely sweeping out any any contextual knowledge that would be useful in moving forward. But I think going back to a point you made a minute ago, when you look at the faith-based thinking, you called it, or the mysticism of any culture, children who are naturally curious, and I would even say naturally empirical, their curiosity, when you look at some of the traditions and mystical beliefs of cultures, really regardless of the time that you're talking about, that curiosity and those questions that these kids have tend to be much more threatening, you know, than it is adorable. I think that's what you're driving at. Am I correct?
Well, it was funny. I mean, I don't know. It seemed like you're adding stuff. But it's kind of like one of the teachers that I spoke to. Actually, it was very, very hard to get teachers on camera, which was fascinating in itself. There's a tremendous culture of fear in the schools themselves. Everyone is looking over their shoulders.
Right.
The teachers are afraid of the administrators. The administrators are afraid of the school board. The school board's afraid of the community. So everyone is just petrified. And the students, of course, the ones that everyone, you know, craps all over. But, this one teacher was saying that the students that teachers are most afraid of aren't the ones that misbehave. It's the ones that don't care. Those are the ones, you know, that just see the arbitrariness and just, you know, he said those are the ones because, you know, they reveal the absurdity of the whole institution and, you know, where the punishments don't mean anything because they just don't. They haven't bought into it. They don't believe in the consequences. And, so it's kind of funny. But actually, one of the projects that I'm working on now is a follow up, you know, separate from film, but because I'm so attached to this particular issue, this is, you know, definitely what, you know, my number one cause is, I'm working on a student resistance, manual. And it's ways that kids can fight back, and it'll be available free for download. It's not a for profit venture. But it's ways that kids can fight back in ways that are actually rational in terms of what kids can actually accomplish individually that don't, and ways that won't get kids in trouble. And that's sort of the goal. And it's a very difficult, challenge to try to come up with things. But it's one that I'm trying to, develop. And one of the approaches is to, have kids go to the school boards and ask that things that apply to them should also apply to the teachers and administrators as far as certain things. Some of the things, you know, as far as the claims they can make, things like zero tolerance policies. Well, if kids aren't allowed to carry guns in school, which, you know, on the surface is, you know, what people, you know, the parents or whatever believe is really going on with zero tolerance. Well, you know, certainly the teachers and administrators shouldn't, but we all know that that's not what's happening as far as the rulings go. But once if a student is then charged with some kind of violation of that policy, then the teachers and administrators would also too, even when it's a plastic knife or something to that effect, once you make these policies universal. It's sort of the vision that I have there is that the way McCarthyism and the Salem witch hunts and things like that ended wasn't through fighting against the injustice of it by the victims. It was it was when it spread out of control to the people in power. So when the military were accused of being communists was when McCarthy was censured. When the governor's wife was accused of being a witch is when the witch hunts ended, and they weren't going to end until they reached the people in power. So children or students can make logical arguments for why something as basic as drugs or guns shouldn't be in the hands of the people who are their guardians. So that's one kind of example. Others is just sort of to make the environment as untenable for everyone involved, you know, as far as, you know, those who are at the schools.
I think that's a really interesting project. And if we could just expand on that for a minute, you're going to take different situations that are common for young people and maybe explain a way out of that situation. Am I understanding you correctly?
Well, it's not a way out. It's a way of making, you know, if, you know, kids are going to meet, you know, you can't expect, things are not going to get better for kids in school. It's just sure. not going to happen. So, and kids are not allowed to protest, and do anything that's disruptive of the environment, or they're going to be suspended or expelled. So the only way that, that a student can rebel is to make the environment as miserable as possible for those in power. And that's the vision goal, or, and to bankrupt the system. And that's the mission there. And there, I mean, there are some things that are gaming the system or making it, making certain things untenable. For instance, in many schools, they have, dogs come in and do, drug sniffing of lockers and things like that. Well, my manual recommends that all the kids leave dog food in their lockers. So the dogs are going to alert to every single locker because they're going to smell the dog food. Well, you can't, how are you going to really stop the kids from having, if not dog food, you can have, legitimate food in your locker. That's really a hard thing for them to legislate that you can't have food in your locker, but it's going to prevent the dogs from being able to function as they desire if they're alerting to every single locker in the school because all the kids have food in their locker. So that's, an example of that kind of thing. Another thing I recommend is that kids, the technology is so small and ubiquitous, it's impossible to police every kind of recording device. Kids should record their teachers all the time and just create this feeling of paranoia. That everyone should be, that the principals, the teachers should all be paranoid at all times that the kids are going to be recording them and that recording is going to be made public, passed maybe to their parents, maybe, onto the internet, however, anonymously or not. But to create this pervasive paranoia and fear of the students.
When you mention making this a miserable experience, I think just reviving or reinvigorating that lost curiosity and applying it to the school environment. Why are we doing this? Why is this happening? Why do you get to do this? Why can't I do this? I think if that was persistent enough, that would create, for lack of a better description, I don't want to say misery, but that would really be an effective challenge to the system. I think kids have these built-in BS detectors, but unfortunately, because of the environment that they're stuck in, it just has to operate so much of the time in like a silent alarm mode, where they know that this is wrong, but they don't have an outlet, they don't have a forum. They don't have any place where they've been made to feel that it's appropriate to express any of that stuff. So it just goes inside, and I think that manifests in a lot of the problems that we see young people having today.
Yeah, definitely. They're made to feel that if they don't like school, they don't like learning.
Right.
They don't like knowledge. And the whole relationship, is perverted through the process as well. And this is one of the central theme that I try to get across in the film is that everything is corrupted in an autocratic environment. And it's, the example I gave in a recent article would be if you were in a North Korean prison cell and you were being tortured, regularly or just in this horrible environment. And then your prison guard came by and was trying to teach you calculus under, threat of torture. Well, you would, obviously you would learn the calculus to whatever degree was required and nothing more. As soon as it was no longer necessary, you would forget what you learned as an act of resistance. Not because knowing calculus in and of itself is anything wrong, but you would associate it with this and it would be your way of rebelling against, that you were forced to learn this. And you would, other inmates, who might learn quickly or pick it up, you would resent because they seem to be kind of in league with, those who are abusive and you would have a lifelong relationship with hating calculus because of the manner it was taught to you. And this is basically, the problem with school and, the problem with the so-called, productive side of school that schools are supposed to educate, but they create this negative association in terms of what is, the alleged contribution that one could claim that school has in spite of all of its profound deficiencies.
And it results in this, the ultimate outcome is this intellectual apathy, too, because anything that is enlightening is associated with exactly what you're talking about, this pain and boredom and suffering and compulsion to do these things. And I think that in the adult world or the public or political world, when people express their criticism, when they step away from this ongoing, thoughtless, positive affirmation of things as they are, and they say, there's some serious problems that we need to look at in this area, we're always met with the same challenges. And this is one of the things that I really liked about the war on kids, is that it doesn't present even the illusion of a panacea. It's non-prescriptive. It's exactly like my show, where I said, I can point these things out and we can look at individual situations and maybe I could tell you what I would do or what I think would be helpful or what I've learned from my mistakes. But I don't have some kind of across-the-board fix-all for the system, because it cannot be fixed. But whenever we try to alert people to the damage that a system like compulsory government school does in the United States and around the world for generations now, and it seems to get worse as the generations go on, obviously, as these kinds of systems do, the challenge that we're always met with is, well, what's your solution? What would you do? And this is like I was saying to you before we started recording. It's people saying, talk to me like a politician. Tell me that you have answers. Tell me that you have a four-step plan. I'll settle for hope and change. I'll settle for America's the greatest country in the world. Just give me something that I can hold on to,
I do present one solution, and that solution is abolish schools. I think that couldn't be more evident. And it's not that the solution doesn't create a whole host of new challenges. It does, and I also acknowledge freely and openly that things for a period of time could be profoundly worse for a period. But that's where I compare schools, with slavery in terms of not literally in terms of the institution, but in terms of having a institution that is unredeemable. And when you abolished slavery, you had millions of former slaves who were destitute and could barely feed themselves. Lynchings took place so that their lives were regularly threatened and endangered. So things in many ways were worse for quite some time. But no rational person would say, well, we should not have abolished slavery, or we should have waited to abolish, to have some kind of magic system, in place, that would account for these, all of the slaves that were about to free. It's a process, and you have to force society's hands to come up. And here it is, 150 years later, and we still have a ways to go. But again, that's part of the process of getting rid of an evil institution that's become an intrinsic part of society. Things could get worse for kids. I doubt it. But in some ways, yeah, in many ways they could. And I freely say, imagine whatever horrible worst case scenario you have, and it could take place, but it'll still be better because there's nothing redeemable about schools. So so it's not that there's a direction, and there's it's not a resolution, but it's a solution, I think, abolishing schools. So that I think comes across, because, you can't defend the institution, at least not rationally.
I forget who it was. Maybe it was Rand. That's the name that comes to mind. The hardest thing to explain is the glaringly evident, which everybody has decided not to see. I think that there were some dead enders towards the end of slavery, the 1850s, the 1860s. I did a show maybe a year and a half ago called Drapetomania about this.
Because I mentioned Drapetomania in the article I wrote about, about in this article I wrote as a contributor for Forbes, where I was talking about just that about how kids are, you know, that they're being drugged for being, you know, rebellious, which is, you know, drapetomania. Yeah, it was, 1851, Dr. Samuel Cartwright had, said, yeah, slaves who wanted to flee had a mental disorder.
Yeah, the guy who did the show with me was a rebellious psychologist, which is, I guess, in that profession, a relatively rare thing. His name was Bruce Levine. He told me about another one, too, called, I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, but I think it was Dysthesia Aethiopis. He correlated it with ADHD, saying it was a slave's failure to pay sufficient attention to the needs of the master. Which yeah, does seem to correlate a little bit with ADD
or ADHD.
That's
amazing. That's amazing and disturbing and you know, ties so perfectly. But yeah, wow.
But people already know. I mean, the reason why I brought up slavery is I think that we both agree that it would not be a valid counterargument if you could clearly show somebody the irrationality and immorality of that system. And their response was, yes, but you have to, I'm not even going to listen to any discussion of that until you show me a plan for farming in this country for the next 5 or 6 decades. You know, I mean, that wouldn't have been acceptable, but that's what we're countered with today. So
yeah.
One thing that's interesting about the film, I know we're running short on time here, but in the film itself, there is no identification of a clear antagonist, you know, like documentary films usually eventually have. And you're not talking about teachers or unions. I know that's been done in documentaries. But what do you see? I mean, if the kids obviously are the protagonist, what is really the, how do you identify the antagonist?
Oh, finally, some original questions. I'm enjoying this.
good.
No one has asked me that. The antagonist is clear to me. The antagonist is the school system itself. It's the institution. And, I actually try to be sympathetic. I mean, one of the things, there are a couple of features. One is I thought I was going to be going after the administrators that implement zero tolerance and the teachers and such. Anyone who agrees to be interviewed with me, I never want to make them bad. I appreciate, you know, that anyone who's willing to, you know, to take their time and volunteer their time. So I really don't want to make any subject look bad. And there were definitely some people who I disagreed with. There were, you know, some principals and administrators who had done some things that I thought were really horrible things, but they did them with good intentions.
Yeah.
And I wanted that to come across, and it is, you know, it is a road to hell thing. And I really got the impression that, by and large, and there were plenty of people who do bad things and know they're doing bad things. And those people didn't want to talk on camera. And by and large, ironically, those people tended to be from the northeast, whereas the people in the South were much more open, and I felt much more sincere, which is why you know, I had to travel quite a bit for the film, was to find that. So I discovered that most of them in general, you know, really had good intentions, and it was the system itself that subverted their best intentions, their best desires. And you know, many of them were really thought they were doing the right things for kids. And it was like that the teacher I talked to at the atheist convention that I mentioned before, who, he didn't realize or just couldn't, you know, it was, you know, this presented this real existential crisis for him and for other teachers, why teachers in particular are very sensitive about the movie. And I did allow a fair amount of teacher bashing in the film, actually. There are a number of things there, and I kind of wrestled with that a little bit and wondered whether or not I should pull back. And it's not that the teachers are the villain; they're not. Again, I'm sympathetic to the teachers, and I think that teachers really try hard. But I did feel that the teachers, you know, I endured enough of teachers dishing it out that I was okay to have them get a taste of that too, and so. But again, the villain, the antagonist is the institution of school, and and it's wrong that people should put their faith in it. And it is faith. And it's a misplaced faith.
Yeah, I think it exposes a certain philosophic corruption in society, too, where people think that that is the framework in which they need to be operating to help children. You know, it really just shows how divorced from reality the idea about what education actually even is, where they say, oh, yes, but this is for the children. And I think that the criticism of teachers in the film is certainly fair, because that's what you interviewed students, you talked to students, and that's what they say, because for them, the system is embodied by the teachers. That's their interface.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't understand or pay any attention to anything that goes on behind that. And that's a real astute observation, too, where you said, you know, everybody's looking over their shoulder, and it's just this, you know, Russian doll of the situation of authority, that it's always going.
It's more like a Mobius strip, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I just did this series about the Nazis because I was talking about the Prussian origins of our education system. So sure. Usually, I mean, last 5 minutes we've done slavery and we've done the Nazis. This is usually where people are like, okay, I'm done debating with you. But
bring it on. But we're not debating.
I'm just saying, in my conversations, those are usually the two cues for the other person to walk away, mention of slavery or mention of the Nazis. But it was so interesting, like, how in school it's all about personalities, and Hitler is presented like this Darth Vader of history, like some kind of evil genius. And he was this incredibly unimpressive, I think I called him a Humpty Dumpty of a man in the show. And the Third Reich was really about, again, this philosophic corruption. In the end, it just had a life of its own. And the virtue was loyalty to the Führer and pleasing of the Führer. So a lot of the things that developed towards the very end, when they really went off the rails there in the last, I mean, it's off the rails to begin with, but like really over the cliff in the last few years there, were people trying to come up with radical revolutionary ideas and programs that would please or excite the Führer, who was crazy. And, I just see this system in the United States. Obviously, it's not a perfect correlation, but I just see it as something that has a life of its own. And because of the absence of critical thinking and because of the absence of curiosity, which the system itself is engendering in its graduates, nobody's questioning anything. And the system has its own kind of authority too. Mike Males, who you mentioned, wrote that article for Alternet. I read it on a show where he talks about some of these things. It was written when I was, I think, a junior in high school. And some of the things he was talking about, like if somebody had told me about that when I was in junior in high school, I wouldn't even have believed it. And now it's like commonplace, the abuses that are going on in these schools. So yeah. It's picking up momentum, it feels like, too.
Yeah. Well, Simone Weil said, yeah, a slave does not become like his master by obeying him. So if you think about like the whole mission there, but Mike Males was one of those nice moments where, you know, meeting a hero was not a letdown. He really was great. One of the other things that I don't really think gets, you know, stated much that I try to get across, cause I'm really so frustrated by, you know, the well-intentioned critics that are just not very deep thinkers.
Yeah.
You know, the people that criticize testing or they criticize, you know, bullying, and often their good intentions of criticism are ultimately detrimental because they don't understand. They're looking at symptoms and they're thinking that that's the underlying problem. It's like, you know, you have cancer and you have headaches because you have a brain tumor and you take some aspirin, you know, that it's going to solve the cancer or the tumor. But the underlying problem, you know, particularly for a situation like bullying that's got all this attention, the solution has been much, much worse because, you know, no one's realizing that the reason why you have bullying going on is because you have a culture of oppressive abuse. And the only way that kids can have any kind of power or control is through bullying other kids because they have no other, you know, power or control or, you know, in their lives. So they have to express it some way. It has to come out. And so what is the solution? The solution is to give teachers, you know, and administrators more power to bully kids, which is the source of bullying in the first place, is perverse culture, you know, as far as catalyst for bullying.
Yeah. And the,
and so you have, you know, laws on the books everywhere that, that give them more authority to, you know, to punish kids for even more, you know, without, you know, any, you know, worse than zero tolerance type things. It's just,
Forced associations too. You know, I mean, you look at the places I've mentioned this, I can't even count how many times I've mentioned this at this point, but where are people getting bullied? Well, where there are forced associations, from which there is no escape. Jail, the military, and, the schools. That's where we see, the worst kinds of emotional and physical aggression and hazing. And I've obviously seen a lot of this in my career because I worked as a teacher for a long time. And I think that a place that it showed up a lot, a couple of kids mentioned this in your movie, was with the jocks. And I think that, you know, I've worked with a lot of overachievers in my career, kids, academics, sports, the school play, the band. Parents demand a lot of them, and there's various reasons for that. But I think a lot of these jocks who are bullying are just trying to get some semblance of control, you know, what they have so little of in their personal lives or in their academic lives as well. So I think there's a variety. There's all of these pressures. I mean, this could be a 10-hour film that you did, right? Because there's so many different aspects to it.
Yeah, originally that was kind of that was the thought and the desire was to do a 10-hour project, because it wasn't all just about schools. It was showing how youth and society also. And then I had all this footage, and I decided to separate it arbitrarily into school and outside of school, and school just happened to be the first one that I decided to focus on first. But it could have been, you know, because the oppression of kids in general outside of school is also completely out of control. I've got some unbelievably disturbing footage of kids getting, you know, attacked for no reason by police, in party environments and under the guise of, I don't even know what, just, you know, curfews and things. And, there is real animosity and hatred of youth in American society, and it's profoundly disturbing, and it's something that everyone is in complete denial about, and no one really has to answer to, for several reasons, not the least of which that youth are disenfranchised, so that there's no political need to respond to the needs of kids, and yet there's the constant lip service of, oh, we're doing it for the kids, and
Yeah,
it's such BS.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm really glad, you know, we got our first look at this film a couple years ago now, but I'm really glad that it's made its way back into the news. Can you tell us what's going on?
Sure. Actually, it's been frustrating, actually, because, the film came out, and then months later, Waiting for Superman, which is just corporate propaganda for charter schools, came out. And basically, you have two different kinds of films. You either have films that are supported by corporate interests because, you know, they're promoting a corporate interest, which is charter schools like The Cartel and Waiting for Superman. And then you have these other films that are just, you know, disappointments to say the least, which are just about, you know, the symptoms of problems and don't actually look or address the underlying, issues of what's really causing these problems. And, so all the air got sucked out of the room after, you know, I started getting all this attention because, you know, that had Guggenheim money behind it. And so I was able to get distribution throughout Europe and the rest of the world through on the Sundance Channel. But I never quite got an explanation for why the Sundance Channel didn't want to show it domestically. I think there was some degree of fear because of the content. But the documentary channel happily took it on, and they're going to be broadcasting it tomorrow, May 6th. At 8 and 11, and then there are a whole number of encore broadcasts that they have throughout May and June for it as well. So it's getting attention that way. It's also available online at thewaronkids.com, at Amazon, and online streaming everywhere, you know, iTunes and Amazon and all that, to get distribution that way. So, the story is getting picked up about it because it is the only film of its kind as far as dealing with, doing the hard work of addressing the institution as opposed to just, superficial concerns.
It's true. There's been a lot of, I was surprised when I tallied them up, but there's been a lot of swings and misses at, the real heart of the issue all the way back to Bowling for Columbine, right? I mean, that was the first one I can think of that even addressed the idea that there was a problem with how young people were being treated.
Yeah. Males did a great critique of that movie.
I bet.
I was really impressed with his writings with there too. One of the things that I've been amazed, I've done quite a number of interviews on this film, but no one has ever asked me about the archival footage that I used from the 1950s, the social engineering thing.
It looks like Coronet Films.
Yeah, they do some, most of them. Yeah, it's all from the Prelinger archives and going through a lot of stuff, but originally, it was done initially, for sort of an entertainment factor to show sort of, but it turned into something very different. I was actually genuinely impressed with the poignancy of the footage. I mean, at times, there is something amusing about the cultural change that's taken place, but I was really shocked by the earnestness of the way they really wanted to deal with a number of the issues, and sometimes it was even touching and sometimes disturbing and funny, but it was definitely a situation where a lot of things haven't changed, and that was certainly meant to be shown, but at the same time I there was a greater sincerity that I wasn't expecting in that footage. But some of it is definitely funny. I mean, and I was glad I was able to find some moments of humor in the film too. Certainly the tour of the prison and the school. I got some criticism over that, which I've always laughed at. Someone said, you don't identify, later on which is the school and which is the prison, and and the audience is going to know which is which. I was like, if they don't know which is which, that's really troubling, don't you think?
Yeah, it's one of the, it's like just from a filmmaking point of view, and I'll end with this and then I'll let you go. I thought there was so much that was just left out of it, right, that creates a kind of uneasiness. Right. It would be one thing if you spent, like we already talked about the no panacea. So it would be one thing if you talked for an hour about these problems and then said, oh, but here's what you do. You elect this guy and we use his 9-point plan. Oh, and people say, oh, well, at least there's a thing to do. But that's absent. And yeah, that kind of scene, I remember the first time I saw it. And even I'm pretty involved in this stuff. And I was like, which one is which? Yeah, so I like how you have that put people a little bit closer to the edge of their seat, and you make them squirm a little bit in this film. And of all the films that have tried to tackle this issue, this one is by far my favorite. And I just have, like I said before, the greatest appreciation because I know not only how the film turned out great, but I'm sure it was just a massive project for many, many years and a real struggle.
It's a labor of love.
Yes.
Really, I mean, and I guess of hate too.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, Kevin, I'd like to have you back in the future sometime, especially when some of your other projects evolve or are actually finished.
Well, I've got one that's coming to theaters in a month, or theater in a month, and some other stuff that's getting completed. But yeah, there's a documentary about a tribe in Uganda that no one had seen for over 40 years that I decided to track down. And that's June 15th. We'll be at the Quad Cinema in New York City as a first stop, and then there's another one about a tribe in Vanuatu that worships America that is another one, and then I'm filming another and editing one about Gilligan's Island and communism, anti-communism, and how they're reflected in it, and And then the erosion of church and state one is what I'm in production on right now.
Well, that's great. And so anytime you'd like to come back and talk about any of them, I'm very interested in this, the tribe that worships America. I remember the first time I heard about this, I thought it was fascinating. What can people in my audience do to help you out?
Well, I do have, you know, I'm so bad at promotion, and that's kind of been my downside. I'm just, you know, I just have so many ideas and so much work I want to be doing and getting out there. Well, also I'm working on a book with the War on Kids, to explain all, you know, that addresses all the different myths about, public education and why it cannot be reformed, you know, to codify it. I think, even though the documentary took me, you know, 8 years to make, you know, a book that I could probably write in 1 year, people seem to have, you know, there's something about the culture of print that people seem to take more seriously, which I understand, and, you know, just to a certain degree. So that's the necessity of that. But, you know, if people wanted to help, they can buy the DVD at thewaronkids.com, and there is a mailing list there. I've yet to do a bulk mailing to anyone on my list. I hate getting spam so much that I'm sensitive even to send out information to people on mailing lists. But I really need to do that, especially because I can send informative stuff. It wouldn't be spam. But I'm overly sensitive to that. But I need to do more there. But yeah, buy the DVD and look out for more stuff that I've got coming on. And I guess that's it right now. I need to update my personal website at kevinsolom.com, but there's some fun stuff there that's more entertaining. But thewaronkids.com is the place to go.
And I'll make sure that there's links to all of this stuff in the show notes for today's podcast. Kevin, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your patience with my technical difficulties. And I definitely look forward to talking to you again in the future.
I really appreciate it. I'm a huge fan of your, you know, of your blog, and I thank you for having me, and I, you know, look forward to keeping updated and other stuff and talking more about anything you'd like to talk about.
Excellent. Thank you so much.